Chapter 19. I was standing at the cab stand waiting. Gustav came up with his car and pulled in behind me.
"How's the pup, Robert?"
he asked.
"He's fine," said I.
"And you?" I waved my hand ill-humoredly.
"I'd be fine, too, if I could earn a bit more.
Think of it. 2 whole 50 pfennig fares today."
He nodded. "It gets steadily worse. Everything is getting steadily worse, and more to come."
"Yes, and I absolutely must have some money," said I.
"Right now. A lot of money."
Gustav scratched his chin.
"A lot of money."
Then he looked at me.
"There's not a great deal to be picked up anywhere, really, unless you speculate. What do you say to the tote? There are races today. I know a first-rate joint. Made 28-1 on Aida there just recently."
"Don't care what it is. Is there a chance? That's the main thing."
"Have you backed horses before?"
"Never."
"Then you have beginner's luck. We might do something with that."
He looked at his watch. "Should we go now? We can just make it."
"Right."
Since the business with the dog, I had a lot of confidence in Gustav. The betting place was a fairly large room. The right half was a cigar stall. On the left was the totalizator. The show window was hung full of green and pink sporting papers and tips. Along one wall ran a counter with writing materials. Behind it were 3 men in frenzied activity. One was shouting down the telephone. Another was running to and fro with slips in his hands. And the third, a bowler hat on the back of his head, rolling a fat black Brazilian cigar between his teeth, coatless, with sleeves rolled up, stood behind the counter noting the bets. His shirt was of the most intense violet. To my surprise, there was plenty of business. They were almost exclusively little people, craftsmen, workers, small clerks, a few prostitutes, and various hangers-on. At the door, a chap with a dirty gray Macintosh, gray bowler hat, and threadbare gray sports coat stopped us.
"Von Beeling. Tips, gentlemen? Dead certs."
"Tell your grandmother," said Gustav, who had suddenly taken on a quite different expression.
"Only 50 pfennigs, urged Beeling. "Know the trainer personally, out of the old days,"
he added at a glance from me.
Gustav was already studying the list of events.
"When does the Otoy come out?" he called across to the counter.
5 o'clock, quacked the assistant.
"Philomena, fat old bitch," growled Gustav.
"Proper draft horse in sticky weather."
He was already sweating with excitement.
"What's the next?"
he asked.
"Hoppegarten," said someone beside him.
Gustav studied further.
"We'll put $2 each on Tristan as a beginning," he announced to me.
"Sure thing."
"Do you know anything about it, then?" I asked.
"Know anything?"
Gustav answered.
"I know every horse's hoof."
"And yet you're backing Tristan?"
said someone alongside us.
"Slippery Liz, man, your only chance. I know Johnny Burns personally."
"And I," retorted Gustav imperturbably, "am the owner of Slippery Liz's stable. I know better still."
He called out bets to the chap at the counter. We received a slip and sat down in the front of the hall where there were some tables and chairs. The air about us was humming with all manner of names. Some workmen were discussing horses racing at Nice, 2 postmen were studying the weather report from Paris, and an ex-coachman was reminiscing about the time when he drove in trotting races. Only 1 fat man with bristling hair sat indifferent at his table, eating 1 bread roll after another. 2 others were leaning against the wall, watching him greedily. Each had a ticket in his hand, but their faces were haggard, as if they had not eaten for days. The telephone rang loudly. All ears pricked up. The assistant called out the names. Of Tristan, not a word was to be heard.
"Damn," said Gustav, and his face flushed. "Solomon's done it. Who'd have thought it? You?"
he demanded of Slippery Liz.
"You were well down, too. Also ran."
Von Beeling appeared between us.
If you'd listened to me, gentlemen, I could have told you Solomon. Only Solomon. If you like, for the next race.
Gustav was not even listening. He had comforted himself and was now involved in a technical discussion with Slippery Liz.
Do you know about horses?
Beeling asked me.
Not a thing, said I. Then back.
Back, but only today, he added in a whisper. And never again. Listen to me. You back. It doesn't matter what. King Lear or Silver Moth. Or perhaps L'Heure Bleue. I don't want any money. Just give me something if you win, that's all.
His chin was trembling with the gambler's passion. I knew from poker the old rule. Beginners often win.
All right, said I.
What on?
Whatever you like. Whatever you like.
L'Heure Bleue doesn't sound bad to me, said I.
10 marks on L'Heure Bleue, then.
Are you cracked? Asked Gustav.
No, said I.
10 of the best on that crock? She ought to have been sausage meat long ago.
Slippery Liz, whom Gustav himself had just been calling a poor sap, chimed in, talking big.
What's that? Backing Laura Blaua, is he? That's a cow, not a horse, sir. May Dream could beat him on 2 legs if he wants to.
Compris?
Beeling looked at me imploringly, making signs.
Compris, said I.
Ach, man.
Gustav looked at me as if I had turned into a Hottentot.
Gypsy, too. Any babe unborn knows that.
I'm sticking to L'Heure Bleue, I announced.
It would have been against all the mystic laws of gambling to change now. The man with the lavender shirt handed me a slip. Gustav and Slippery Liz eyed me as if I had the plague. They moved off from me and elbowed to the counter, there with mutually scornful laughter, in which lurked nevertheless the respective professionals for one another, to back Gypsy 2 and May Dream. At that moment, someone keeled over. It was one of the 2 thin fellows who a while ago had been standing by the tables. He slithered along the wall and crashed hard onto the floor. The postman picked him up and put him on a chair. His face was grayish-white. His mouth was open.
Good Lord, said a prostitute,
a full, dark woman with smooth hair and a low forehead.
Fetch a glass of water, somebody.
It struck me how few people took any notice of the fainting man. The majority just gave a fleeting glance and then turned again to the betting.
Happens all the time, said Gustav. Unemployed. Bet away every bean. Always at long odds, 100 to 1.
The coachman came out of the cigar department with a glass of water. The dark prostitute dipped her handkerchief into it and wiped it over the man's forehead and temples. He sighed and suddenly opened his eyes. There was something uncanny about the way they were suddenly there again, without a sound, in the completely extinguished face, as if some other unknown being peered, curious and inquisitive, through the slits of a rigid gray-white mask. The girl took the glass of water and gave the man a drink. As she did so, she held him like a child in her arm. Then she reached a sandwich from the table of the unconcerned eater with the bristling hairs.
Come now, eat. But slowly, slowly. Don't bite my finger off. There. And now drink again.
The man at the table followed the sandwich with his eyes, but he said nothing. The other slowly regained color. He ate a while longer, then staggered up. The girl supported him and pushed him toward the door. Then, with a swift glance behind, she unzipped her handbag.
There. Now hop it, and eat instead of betting.
One of the hangers-on who had kept his back turned all this time turned around. He had the face of a bird of prey, with standoff ears and wore patent leather shoes and a sports cap.
What did you give him? He asked.
Groschen.
He dug her in the chest with his elbow.
It was more than that. Ask me next time.
Go easy, Ada, said another.
The prostitute took out her powder box and rouged her lips. It's true, though, said Ada. The prostitute did not answer. The telephone rang. I looked at Ada and could not make him out. That's what is called a swine, I heard Gustav suddenly burst out. That's more than a swine, ladies and gentlemen. That's a great fat mother sow with 20 porkers. He clapped me on the shoulder. 180 marks you've rattled, my boy. Your camel with the funny name has done it. What, really? I asked. The chap with the chewed cigar and the brilliantly colored shirt nodded sourly and took my ticket.
Who gave you the tip?
I did, said Beeling with a dreadfully cringing, expectant smile, coming forward with a bow. I did. If I may venture, my connections...
Ah, man.
The fellow did not so much as look at him and paid me the money. For a moment, there was complete silence in the room. Everybody watched. Even the imperturbable eater lifted his head. I pocketed the notes.
Stop now, whispered Beeling. No more.
He had red spots on his cheeks. I pushed 10 marks into his hand. Gustav grinned and punched me in the ribs. You see, what did I tell you? You've only to listen to Gustav to shovel up money. I refrained from reminding the ex-sergeant stretcher-bearer of Gypsy 2. He appeared to have made his own reflections on that matter. Let's go, said he. Today's not a good day for artists. At the door, someone plucked me by the sleeve. It was Slippery Liz.
What's your tip for the Maslovsky benefit race?
He asked with covetous respect. Oh, Tannenbaum, said I, and went with Gustav to the nearest pub to drink a glass to the health of L'Heure Bleue. An hour later, I had lost 30 marks again. I could not leave well alone. But then I did stop. As I went, Beeling thrust a card into my hand. If you ever want anything, or your friends, I'm the representative. It was an advertisement for home cinemas. I also negotiate the sale of left-off clothing, he called after me. Cash! About 7 o'clock, I returned to the workshop. Carl was standing in the yard, roaring.
Lucky you came, Bob, called Custer. We're just going to run him in. Come.
The entire firm was standing by. Otto had changed and improved several details about Carl because he wanted to enter him for a mountain climb in a fortnight's time. The first trial run was about to take place. We climbed in. Jupp sat beside Custer, his immense goggles in front of his face. It would have broken his heart not to come. Lentz and I got in behind. Carl darted off. We reached the long bypass and opened out to 140 kilometers. Lentz and I huddled close under the backrests of the seats in front. It was a wind to blow your head off. The poplars on either side bolted past, and the wonderful sound of the engine thrilled in us like the wild cry of freedom. A quarter of an hour later, we sighted ahead a black point, which rapidly grew larger. It was a fairly heavy car traveling at a speed of between 80 and 100 kilometers. It was not holding the road particularly well, but swayed to and fro. The track was rather narrow. Custer accordingly slackened speed. When we were about 100 meters distant and about to hoot, we suddenly saw a motorcyclist approaching from the right on a side road. Immediately he vanished behind a haystack just before the crossing.
God, that's done it, called Lentz.
At the same moment, a motorcyclist appeared on the road 20 meters in front of the car. He had apparently underestimated the car's speed and was now trying to get past by sweeping round in front of it. The car pulled sharply to the left to get out of the way, but the motorcycle also now lurched to the left. The car was again jerked to the right, and the mudguard brushed the cycle, which flung round. The cyclist shot head over heels onto the road. The car skidded, failed to right itself, tore down the signpost, smashed a lamp standard, and finally crashed into a tree. It all happened in a couple of seconds.
The next moment it was we, at our high speed, had already caught up with it. The tires snarled. Custer steered Carl through like a horse among the cyclists, the bicycle, and the puffing car, now standing crosswise on the road. On the left, he'd just missed the cyclist's hand, and on the right, the carrier of the car. Then the engine roared. Carl pulled again into the straight. The brakes shrieked, and all was still.
"Well done, Otto," said Lentz.
We ran back and pulled open the doors of the car. The engine was still running. Custer reached for the switchboard and pulled out the key. The coughing of the engine died away, and we heard someone groaning. Every window of the heavy limousine was shattered. In the semi-darkness of the interior, we saw the face of a woman streaming with blood. Beside her was a man jammed between the steering wheel and seat. We first lifted out the woman and laid her on the road. Her face was full of cuts. A few splinters were still sticking in it, but the blood flowed steadily. It was worse with her right arm. The sleeve of her white blouse was bright red and dripping fast. Lentz slid it up. A surge of blood flowed out, then went on pulsing. The artery was severed. Lentz twisted his handkerchief to a tourniquet.
"Get the man out. I'll be done here in a minute," said he.
"We must get to the nearest hospital quickly." To extricate the man, we had to unscrew the back of the seat. Fortunately, we had enough tools with us, and it went pretty quickly. The man was bleeding likewise, and apparently had some ribs broken. When we helped him out, he dropped with a cry. There was something up with his knee, too, but we could do nothing for it at the moment. Custer drove Carl in reverse close up to the place of the accident. The woman screamed hysterically from fear when she saw him coming so near, though he drove only at a walk. We put down the back of one of the front seats, and so were able to let the man lie down. The woman we placed in the back seat. I took up a position beside her on the running board while Lentz held the man on the other side.
"You stay here and look after the car, Jupp," said Lentz.
"By the way, what's become of the cyclist?" I asked.
"Hopped it while we were busy," announced Jupp.
We drove off slowly. Not far from the next village was a small sanatorium. We had often seen it when passing. It lay white and low on a hillside. So far as we knew, it was a sort of private asylum for mild, well-to-do patients, but there was sure to be a doctor there and some sort of dressing station. We drove up the hill and rang. A very pretty nurse came out. She turned pale at the sight of the blood and ran back. Immediately, a second, decidedly older one came out.
"Sorry," she said at once. "We are not equipped for accidents. You must go to the Virchow Hospital. It's not far."
"It's a good hour from here," replied Custer. The nurse looked her refusal.
"We aren't equipped for this kind of thing. Besides, there's no doctor."
"Then you're infringing the law," declared Lentz. "Private institutions of this kind must have a resident doctor. Would you allow me to use your telephone? I should like to speak to the police and one of the newspapers."
The nurse began to weaken. "I don't think you need worry," said Custer coldly. "Anything you do will certainly be well repaid. What we need is a stretcher. I expect you can get hold of a doctor, all right." She still hesitated.
"A stretcher," explained Lentz, "is also statutory, and first aid material likewise."
"Yes, yes," she replied hastily, evidently floored by so much information.
"I'll send someone at once."
She vanished. "A bit tough," said I.
"Meet the same sort of thing in public hospitals," replied Lentz mildly. "First comes money, then red tape, then help."
We went back to the car and helped the woman out. She did not say anything, merely looked at her hands. We took her into a small consulting room off the entrance. Then the stretcher arrived for the man. We lifted him onto it. He groaned.
"A moment."
We looked at him. He closed his eyes.
"I don't want any trouble," said he with difficulty.
"It wasn't your fault," replied Custer.
We witnessed the accident and will willingly give evidence for you.
It's not that,
said the man. For other reasons, I don't want it known.
You understand?
He glanced toward the door through which the woman had gone.
Then you're in the right place here, explained Lentz. This is a private show. All it wants now is for your car to disappear before the police spot it.
The man propped himself up.
Could you do that for me? Ring up some garage. And please, let me have your address. I'm very much obliged to you.
Custer made a gesture of refusal.
But yes, said the man, I'd like to.
Quite simple, replied Lentz. We have a repair shop ourselves, and specialize in cars like yours. We'll take it along, if you agree, and put it in order again. That'll help you and us at the same time.
Good, said the man. Do you want my address?
Then I'll come myself and get the car, or send somebody.
Custer put the visiting card in his pocket, and we carried him in. The doctor, a young chap, had arrived in the meantime. He had washed the blood from the woman's face, and the deep cuts were now visible. The woman lifted herself on her sound arm and stared into the shining nickel of a bowl on the dressing trolley.
Oh,
said she softly, and dropped back with horror-stricken eyes. We drove to the village and inquired for a garage. It was a smithy, and from the blacksmith we borrowed a breakdown outfit and a hawser, promising him 20 marks for the loan. But he was suspicious and wanted to see the car. We took him with us and drove back. Jupp was standing in the middle of the road and waving, but without that, we saw already what was the trouble. An old, top-heavy Mercedes was standing by the roadside, and four people were in the act of getting away with the Stutz.
We've arrived in nice time, said Custer.
That's the brothers Vogt, replied the blacksmith. Dangerous crew. Live over there. They don't give up what they once get their fingers on.
We'll see about that, said Custer.
I've explained it all to them already, Herr Custer, whispered Jupp. Dirty rivals. Want to have the car for their own shop.
Very good, Jupp. You stay here for the time being.
Custer went up to the biggest of the four and addressed him. He explained that the car belonged to us.
Have you got anything hard on you? I asked Lentz.
Only a bunch of keys, and I want that myself. Get a small spanner.
Better not, said I. Might do real damage. Pity I have such light shoes. Otherwise, kicking might be best.
Coming in? Lentz asked the blacksmith. Then we'll be four against four.
I'm keeping out. Don't want my show smashed up tomorrow. I'm strictly neutral.
Quite right, said Lentz.
I'm with you, announced Jupp. Don't you be rash, said I. See that nobody comes, that's enough.
The blacksmith retired from us a space farther to emphasize his strict neutrality.
Don't you talk tripe!
I suddenly heard the biggest of the brothers Vogt growl at Custer.
First in, first served. Finish. Now you shove off.
Custer explained once more that the car belonged to us. He offered to drive Vogt to the sanatorium to find out for himself. Vogt grinned contemptuously. Lentz and I came nearer.
Perhaps you'd like to go to the hospital yourself? Asked Vogt.
Custer did not answer, but walked up to the car. The other three Vogts straightened up. They were now standing close together.
Give that trolley here, said Custer to us.
Man,
replied the eldest Vogt. He was a head taller than Custer.
Sorry, said Custer, but we're going to take the car.
Lentz and I sauntered still nearer, hands in our pockets. Custer bent down to the car. At the same moment, Vogt rooted him aside with a kick. Otto had reckoned with that. The same instant he had seized the leg and flung Vogt down. Then he leapt up and hit the next of the brothers, who had just raised the starting handle, in the belly, so that he reeled and fell likewise. The next moment, Lentz and I jumped for the other two. I stopped one in the face at once. It was not bad, but my nose started to bleed. My next punch missed its mark and glanced off the other's greasy chin. Then I got a second wipe in the eye and guarded so ill that with a belly punch, the folk brought me down. He pressed me upon the asphalt and gripped my throat. I tensed the muscles so that he should not choke me and tried to bend and roll over in order to shove him off with my feet or to kick him in the guts. But Lentz and his folk were struggling on top of my legs, and I could not get free. Despite the taut neck muscles, I had difficulty in breathing. I could not get air because of my bleeding nose. Gradually, everything turned glassy around me. Folk's face quivered before my face like jelly, and I felt black shadows in the back of my brain. With a last glance, I saw Jupp suddenly beside me. He was kneeling in the gutter by the roadside, calmly and attentively watching my struggles, and when the final pause seemed to have made all ready for him, struck Focht's wrist with a hammer. At the second blow, Focht let go, and from the ground made a fierce grab at Jupp, who slipped back a foot or so, and in all calmness landed him a third on the fingers and then one on the head. I came up, rolled on top of Focht, and in my turn set about strangling him. At that moment, there was a wild animal bellow and then a whimpering. "Let go! Let go!" It was the eldest Focht. Custer had twisted his arm and forced it up his back. Focht had gone down with his head to the ground, and Custer was now kneeling on him and twisting the arm farther. Focht yelled, but Custer knew that he must finish him properly if we were to be left in peace. With a sudden jerk, he wrenched his arm and then let him go. Focht remained a while lying on the ground. I looked up. One of the brothers was still standing, but his brother's cries had taken the fight out of him. "You clear out, or I'll start over again," said Custer to him. I gave my Focht's head a farewell bump on the road and then let him go. Lentz was already standing by Custer. His coat was torn. He was bleeding from the corner of his mouth. The battle had apparently been a draw, for his Focht, though bleeding also, was standing. The surrender of the eldest brother had settled the lot. None of them ventured a word. They helped the eldest up and went to their car. The uninjured one returned and collected the starting handle. He looked at Custer as if he were the devil. Then the Mercedes rattled off. Suddenly the blacksmith was there again. "They've had enough," said he. "Nothing like it has happened to them in a long time. The eldest has done time already for manslaughter." Nobody answered. Custer suddenly shook himself. "Dirty business," said he. Then he turned round. "Come on, get busy." "I've started," answered Jupp, already trundling up the breakdown trolley. "Here a minute," said I. "From today on, you are a lance corporal and can start cigarette smoking." We heaved the car up and made it fast with the wire rope behind Carl. "Do you think it won't damage him?" I asked Custer. "After all, he's a racehorse, not a pack mule." He shook his head. "It's not so far. And level going." Lentz sat in the studs, and we drove slowly off. I held my handkerchief to my nose and looked out over the evening fields and into the sinking sun. There was an immense, unshakable peace in it, and one felt how utterly indifferent nature was to anything that this evil-tempered antheap called humanity might choose to do in the world. Far more important was it that the clouds now turned gradually to a range of golden mountains, that the purple shadows of twilight drifted in noiselessly from the horizon, that the larks turned home from the boundless space of the sky to their place in the furrow, and that it slowly became night. We drove into our courtyard.
Lentz climbed out of the Stutz and festively took off his hat to it.
Greetings, well-beloved. You come to us by a sad mischance, but with any luck, you should bring us in at a superficial estimate between 3,000 and 3,500 marks. And now give me a large cherry brandy and a cake of soap. I must get rid of the Folkt family.
We all had a glass, and then set to work at once, taking the Stutz apart as far as possible. It was not always enough that the owner alone should give one a repair job. Often the insurance company would come along afterwards to place the car elsewhere with one of its subsidiary shops, so the further we could get, the better for us. The costs of reassembling would then be so high that it would be cheaper to leave the car with us. It was dark when we stopped.
Are you taking the taxi out tonight? I asked Lentz.
Certainly not, replied Gottfried. One shouldn't overdo this money-making business. The Stutz is enough for me for one day.
Not for me, said I. If you're not driving, then I'll graze the nightclubs from 11 to 2.
You let it be, grinned Gottfried. Look in the glass instead. You've been having bad luck with your nose lately. Nobody would ride with you with a beetroot like that. Go home quietly and put it in a cold compress.
He was right. It really was impossible with my nose, so I shortly took my leave and went home. On the way, I met Hasse and walked the last bit with him. He looked dusty and miserable.
You've got thinner, said I. He nodded and told me that he never got proper meals at night now. Almost every day, his wife spent with friends she had found and didn't come home till late. He was glad for her to have the entertainment, but he had no inclination to cook for himself alone when he got in at night. And anyway, he wasn't very hungry. He was too tired for that. I looked at him as he walked beside me with drooping shoulders. Perhaps he really believed what he said, but it was pitiful to listen to. It was only for the want of a little bit of security, a little bit of money, that this marriage, this humble, inoffensive life, had foundered. I thought of the millions there were like him, and that it was always only for the little bit of security and the little bit of money. In a revolting way, life had shrunk to a miserable battle for bare existence. I thought of the fight that afternoon. I thought of what I had seen these last weeks. I thought of all the things I had tried already. And then I thought of Pat, and suddenly had the feeling that the gulf could never be bridged. The leap was too wide. Life had become too dirty for happiness. It couldn't last. One didn't believe in it anymore. This was only a breathing space, not a harbor. We climbed up the stairs and opened the door. On the landing, Hasse stopped.
Well, au revoir.
You eat something tonight, said I. He shook his head with a feeble smile, as if to ask pardon for himself, and went into his empty, dark room. I looked after him. Then I went along on the tube of the corridor. Suddenly I heard soft singing. I stopped and listened. It was not, as I first thought, Erna Bernig's gramophone. It was Pat's voice. She was alone in her room singing. I looked across toward the door behind which Hasse had vanished. I bent down and listened. And then suddenly, I pressed my hands together. Damn it all. Breathing space or no breathing space, harbor or no harbor, be they sundered so far that they will never be bridged, never be believed, for that very reason. Because one could not believe it, for that reason was it always so bewilderingly new and overwhelming. Happiness. Pat did not hear me come in. She was sitting on the floor in front of the looking glass trying on a hat. A little black cap. Beside her on the carpet stood the lamp. The room was filled with a warm, golden-brown twilight, and only her face was brightly lit from the lamp. She had drawn up a chair,
from which hung down a bit of silk. On the seat lay a pair of scissors, gleaming. I remained quietly standing in the door and watched her gravely working at the cap. She was fond of sitting on the floor, and I had often before found her fallen asleep in some corner on the floor, a book beside her, and the dog. The dog was beside her now and started to growl. Pat looked up and saw me in the mirror. She smiled, and it seemed to me that the whole world became brighter by it. I crossed the room, knelt down behind her, and after all the filth of the day, put my lips on the warm, smooth skin of the neck before me. She held up the black cap.
"I've altered it, darling. Do you like it?"
"It is a perfectly lovely hat," said I.
"But you're not even looking. I've cut the brim away behind and turned up the front."
"I can see that quite clearly," said I, with my face in her hair. "It is a hat to make a Paris milliner green with envy if she could see it."
"But Robbie," laughing, she pushed me back. "You haven't any idea about it at all. I wonder sometimes if you ever see what I have on."
"I see every little detail," I declared, sitting close beside her on the floor, though a bit in the shadow on account of my nose.
"So, then what did I have on last night?"
"Last night, I meditated. I actually did not know."
"Just what I expected, darling. You don't know anything at all about me."
"True," said I, "but that is what makes it so nice. The more we know one another, the more we misunderstand one another. And the nearer we know one another, the more estranged we become. Look at the Haases, for instance. They know everything about each other, and yet are more distasteful to one another than total strangers." She put on the little black cap and examined it in the mirror.
"What you said, then, is only half true, Robbie."
"That's the way with all truths," I replied. "We never get further than that. That's what makes us human. And God knows we make trouble with our half-truths. With the whole truth, we couldn't live at all." She took off the hat and put it away. Then she turned round and, as she did so, caught sight of my nose.
"What's this?"
she asked, alarmed. "Nothing serious. It only looks so. When I was working under the car, something dropped on me." She eyed me incredulously.
"Goodness knows where you've been. You never tell me anything, do you? I know as little of you as you do of me."
"And that's the best way," said I. She fetched a basin of water and a cloth and made me a compress. Then she contemplated me once more.
"It looks like a punch. And your neck is scratched, too. You've had some adventure or other, darling."
"My biggest adventure today is still to come," said I. She looked at me surprised.
"So late, Robbie. Are you going out, then?"
"I'm staying here," I replied, throwing the compress away and taking her in my arms. "I'm staying here with you the whole evening."